as I said.
This is Ms. G, and I'm bringing you Telling Tales with Ms. G tonight. And happy Beltane, everyone. It is the time between spring and summer, time to do a little fire ritual and have some fun. And in honor of that, I have some wonderful Irish folk tales for you tonight. So, I'll be right back with my first little story, and I hope you stay tuned. This is Ms. G with Telling Tales. This is Ms. G. I'm bringing you Telling Tales with Ms. G tonight. And in honor of Beltane, I'm bringing you some Irish folk and fairy tales by Michael Scott. The first story up tonight is titled, Birth of the Shannon. Sinan crouched behind the hedge of wild holly, watching the Arch-Mage complete the incantation and put the final touches to the runes incised into the crystal fountain. The druids stepped back, and the Arch-Mage touched the base of the fountain with his long alder wand. Immediately, water rose and fell in a graceful arc, fracturing into a million tiny diamonds in the first slanting rays of the morning sun. He then touched each of the 7 hazel trees that surrounded the fountain, linking them to it in a protective circle. The leaves on the trees began to tremble violently. The berries pulsed and throbbed with slow persistence, and almost before their eyes, the hazelnuts swelled and hardened. The Arch-Mage bowed reverently. "Behold the fruit of knowledge." The druids murmured a refrain as the old man went from tree to tree inspecting the fruit. "They are all perfect. Our task is complete." He leaned upon his long staff, and his hard gray eyes softened as they stared into the morning sun. "It is the beginning of the end." When the sun hit his back, he turned and walked away from the small grove surrounding the crystal fountain. "How long will it last?" asked one of the younger men. "Until man gains the knowledge to breach defenses." He gestured back towards the grove. "We have gathered together the entire knowledge of the Tuatha Dé Nanann and those 7 trees and in the fruit they bear. We cannot allow it to fall into the wrong hands." The voices faded as they passed beyond the maid and disappeared amongst the trees. Sinan waited until she was sure they had gone before coming out from behind the bushes. The wan sunlight sparkled off her dark hair and highlighted the green tinge to her pale skin. She raised a web-fingered hand and shielded her oddly slanting eyes. For Sinan was kin to Lir, the lord of the sea. Slowly she walked towards the grove. Even from a distance it radiated an aura of power, of strength held tightly under control. And this crystal fountain was at the center of the power. It was a protective talisman which linked the 7 artificially mutated trees in an unbreakable bond. The trees were more delicate than normal hazels, their branches longer and the colors of their leaves more vibrant. Only the fruit seemed the same. But the fruit of the trees contained the 7 branches of learning, the entire knowledge of the people of the goddess. And it was hers for the taking. Sinan smiled, her sharp teeth glinting yellow in the light. With the knowledge she gained, she could vanquish the remnants of the Tuatha and rule the younger, stronger race of man. She would be immortal. She stood beside the fountain, touching the blocks. The crystal was surprisingly warm to her touch and soft, rather like skin, yet the water itself was cold, ice cold. The druids would not leave the grove here. She knew they intended to shift it beyond this world to a shadowland, a place apart, where it would be accessible only to someone with great knowledge and arcane power. She trailed her hand through the chill water, reveling in the tingling sensation that engulfed her hand and forearm. She could feel the power of the place crawl over her body and raise the short hairs on the back of her neck. With a shiver, she stretched out her hand to pluck one of the hazelnuts, and her world exploded. The fountain seemed to erupt in all directions. An icy hand gripped the maid and dashed her against the ground again and again. She retched as foul water forced its way into her lungs, choking her, drowning her. But she couldn't drown. It was inconceivable. She was a water maiden. Sinan attempted to breathe the water and extract the life-giving oxygen and failed. The maid panicked. Her arms thrashed wildly and her legs scrambled for purchase. But the grove was gone. The fountain was gone. There was nothing except a world of ice-cold water, which paradoxically burned her throat and eyes like fire. She was lifted higher and higher. She attempted to scream, but there was no sound. She was deaf. The water continued to rise and rise. Abruptly, it fell. The huge wave carried the shattered, lifeless body of the maid south and west, cutting a deep and wide swath through the lush countryside until it reached the Western Ocean. It was a magnificent river, and one later generations would call the Shannon, in memory of the maid. You've just heard me read The Birth of the Shannon, out of the Irish Folk and Fairy Tales by Michael Scott. I'll be back with another short Irish folk tale in just a moment. This is Ms. G, bringing you Telling Tales with Ms. G here at 104.3 in Juneau, Alaska. Ms. G, I'm bringing you Telling Tales with Ms. G. Tonight, on this night of Beltane, the next story is The Garden of the Tuatha De Danann. Tassin the Mage raised his alder wand high and cried aloud in the old tongue. The wand erupted into rising eldritch flames, bathing the Mage in emerald light and turning the night into an eerie semblance of day. A ghost wind sprang up, whipping out of the darkness, bringing with it the scent of cloves mingled with the heavy tang of salt, as if it had blown across the seas from distant lands. But he was many leagues from the sea. Catherine whirled the wand and then struck it against the ground. A single leaden bolt exploded from the starlit sky and struck the ground almost directly in front of the Mage. The harsh bone-white light lent his thin features a ghastly appearance, like one long dead. But where the levin bolt had struck, the ground glowed and shimmered in the emerald wan light, and long tendrils of fog rose from the earth. The fog twisted and coiled in the ghost wind, coalescing into a shifting fog bank. Catherine spoke again, his words trembling on the sharp night air. The green light paled and shrank back into the smoldering wand, and out of the fog came a glowing milk-white light, softer than sunlight, sharper than moonlight. Catherine shut his eyes, knowing that to look now would be to destroy his sight forever, for the mind could not comprehend the opening of the door between the worlds. He waited until the light dimmed against his eyelids and the warm clove and salt-scented breeze was blowing steadily against his face, ruffling his long dark hair, and then he opened his eyes and looked into another world, into the garden of the Tuatha De Danann. Catherine stepped forward and looked through the shifting oval of white fog hanging on the night air. The garden was smaller than he had expected. He could see a small crystal fountain set in the center of seven small delicate hazel trees, whose leaves burned with harsh vibrant colors. No insect or bird flew about the trees, and nothing crawled about their roots. It was a dead world. Catherine stepped into the shadowland. The shock ripped through his body, leaving him pain-racked and gasping on the sickly pale sward of the place apart. Almost immediately, he became aware of the delicate music of the crystal fountain. The water rose and fell in a graceful arc, each drop of water sharp and distinct on the silent air, for there was no other sound. The noise of the air, of the water grew and grew until each drop seemed to shatter in the innermost recesses of his mind. With a groan, he lurched to his feet and stood whilst the landscape swayed before his eyes. He pressed his hands against his ears, but he could still hear the falling water. He took a step forward and fell. Slowly, he began to crawl towards the crystal fountain, gritting his teeth against the tearing cry of the water. Dark waves rippled across his tortured eyes, and his head pounded in unison. With an agonizing effort, he stretched to his fullest, and the tips of his fingers touched the jewel-like water. Bringing his wet fingers back to his lips, he drank. The liquid flowed down his throat like ice with a delicate, almost perfumed taste. Abruptly, he realized the pain was gone, or else he was no longer aware of it. Carefully, he pulled himself to his feet and staggered across to the fountain. The crystal was cool and sensuous beneath his fingers, with a texture that resembled human skin. He dipped a hand in the sparkling water and drank from his cupped palm, savoring the sweetness and delicacy of the liquid. He stared deeply into the diamond-studded depths and found himself wondering what he had come here for. The Maj experienced a brief moment of panic. He could recall neither his name nor his mission, and then he turned and looked back at the way he had come. The milky opalescent wall that surrounded the garden was rent and torn, and through the gaping hold he could make out the tiny points of distant starlight from another world. Memory returned. He was Catherine, a Maj, come in search of the fabled fruit of knowledge in the mythical garden of the Tuatha De Danann, and he had found it. He walked around the fountain and inspected the trees. He could only admire the ancient druids of the people of the goddess who had moved this entire grove from their world to this shadowland, where it would be safe from the curiosity of man. And only when the new race had gained enough knowledge to breach the defenses would the knowledge of the demigods be released. Only once in the first days of its creation had the garden been disturbed, and then the waters of the fountain had risen and swept the intruder away. Catherine gathered the hazelnuts from the seven trees. They were hard and smooth, and deep down a low pulse seemed to beat. He cracked one and bit down hard on the kernel, wincing at the acrid, bitter taste. He began to chew methodically. When he finished, he sat down with his back to the crystal fountain, the trickle of water now pleasant and lulling. The bitter taste of the nut had faded, and his mouth and tongue now tingled as if it had eaten a fresh apple. He breathed deeply. Strange thoughts flashed across his mind's eye. Warriors with flashing swords and clad in gilded armor fought beastmen. Sorcerer druids fought with fire and lightning from hilltop to hilltop. Great armies clashed across sodden marshes, their blood staining the dark earth an even deeper hue. High, proud ships appeared over the horizon, promising death and destruction. Faces flickered before the Maja's eyes, high-boned, slant-eyed, arrogant faces, with hair as fine as silk and eyes harder than jewels. There were women of incredible beauty wielding swords and spears with the skill of warriors, and warriors laboriously working with precious metals and rare gems to create artifacts of delicate beauty. The Tuatha De Danann. The Maj shook his head, attempting to clear his head. Gradually, the alien images faded and settled back into his mind to be called upon if needed. All the images but one. A face drifted before his eyes, the face of an old, old man. The face solidified until Catherine could see the iron-gray hair, still streaked with black, and the curious innocence in the pale, almost colorless eyes. Speak. The voice rang hollowly in the Maj's head, and although the image had not moved its lips, he knew it had spoken. I have a question, he began hesitantly. Then ask it. The image seemed to regard him with some amusement. Is there a meaning to this existence? The image laughed, a long, mellow laugh that reminded Catherine of a god's. Herein are gathered the seven branches of learning of the Tuatha De Danann, the people of the goddess. Herein is knowledge, and knowledge is power. Used correctly, it can make you the ruler of your world, or its destroyer. But in all that accumulated knowledge, you will find no answer to your question. The image paused and began to fade. An icy wind blew across the Maj, and when the voice came again, it echoed with it from a great distance. For there is no meaning. And the fountain erupted in all its fury. You've been listening to me read The Garden of the Tuatha De Danann by Michael Scott from the Irish Folk and Fairy Tales. This is Ms. G. I'm bringing you Telling Tales with Ms. G tonight on this Beltane evening. Please stay tuned and I'll be right back. This is Ms. G. I'm bringing you Telling Tales with Ms. G tonight here at KTO 104.3. I have one last story for you tonight on this Beltane Eve. The Fairy Host. The silence of the night was broken by the sharp, ringing steps of a late traveler on the frost-rimmed road. The young man tucked his head down deeper into his collar and pushed his hands into his pockets, feeling the chill bite through the thin cloth. It was a bitter night, and a full moon sparkled on the road, etching in its silver, the harsh light adding to the chill. He stopped and pulled a hip flask from his back pocket. The locally brewed liquor burned its way down his throat and settled in his stomach like hot coals, and the fumes made him pleasantly unaware of the lateness of the hour or the lonely road he traveled. He had been humming the refrain of an air the piper had played back in the town for some time, when he became aware that his voice was not the only one on the road that night. He stopped and listened, and there, sharp and clear in the distance, he could hear voices raised in laughter and song, with the thin skirl of the pipes and the delicate tracery of a harp hanging on the air. The young man leaned on the hedge that bordered the road and stared across the fields, but he could see nothing, and the night was so clear that the sounds could have traveled for some distance. But his curiosity had been aroused, and ignoring all the tales the country folk told of this part of the West, and the warnings never to leave the road, especially at the full of moon, he vaulted the hedge and set out across the frozen fields towards the sounds. The fields, he knew, were part of the estate of the O'Donnell, the local landlord, an evil man with a dark reputation. A man of whom it was said bore an uncanny resemblance to both his father and grandfather. The young man stumbled and fell on the hard earth. He groaned aloud and then screamed as a hand came out of the night and helped him to his feet. He cowered back and stared up at the stranger. No, not a stranger, someone familiar. He shook his head, trying to clear the fumes and dizziness that made his senses swim. "You are Cullen McMannan," stated the stranger. The young man nodded dumbly, and then recognition dawned. You are the O'Donnell," he whispered, and unconsciously crossed himself. "Why are you trespassing on my land?" "I heard the music and singing, sir, and I just followed it." The O'Donnell smiled, and Colum shivered, for it gave his face a skull-like appearance in the bleached moonlight. He recalled the stories whispered about this man, and especially the one which said that he had traded his soul and humanity for communication with the elder gods and spirits that once walked the land. "Why, then," the O'Donnell said, "let us find the source of this merriment." He gripped Colin by the hand, and the young man winced and would have pulled away if he could, for although the night was chill, the man's hand was even colder. The O'Donnell hurried across the fields, his footing sure and certain, never stumbling nor falling, dragging Colin behind him. And if he had not been gripped so tightly, the young man would have believed he followed a wraith, for the man made no more sound than blown smoke and was almost as visible. He was clad all in black, from his high-collared jacket to his black hose, and save for the silver buckles on his shoes and the silver buttons that glittered like tiny stars on his jacket, he would have been invisible. They marched across field after field, pushing through frozen hedge groves and ice-sheathed rivers and streams. Several times, Colum tried to strike up a conversation with the dark figure before him, but his words hung, forced and empty on the cold air, and the O'Donnell did not deign to reply. Eventually, they topped a rise and found themselves looking down into a hollow. The depression must have been almost a half mile across, topped on three sides by trees and low bushes. The silver thread of a stream cut across from the left and vanished into the night. And although it was dark in the hollow, Colum could see vague forms moving to and fro. The O'Donnell pointed down. "There is the source of your music and laughter. They dance within." Colum strained, but the sounds were still as distant as ever. And who were they? He turned back to the older man, but he was gone, vanished into the night whence he came. The young man backed away from the hollow, fully intending to turn and run when he could bear to have the sounds at his back. But suddenly there was movement in the hollow, and two figures loomed up out of the shadows. They were smaller than he, and clad in somber colors of peculiar cloth which reflected the moonlight like oiled silk. Their features were thin and pointed, their eyes slanted upwards and seemed split-pupiled like a cat's. Their hands, when they reached for him, were long and thin, with delicate, graceful fingers and long, overlong nails. Taking him by the hands, they drew the young man down into the hollow. It was as if he were walking underwater, all sounds ceased and were replaced with a muffled pounding like the surf on the sands, and which he abruptly realized was the pounding of his own heart. Familiar objects, even the trees, took on grotesque and fantastic shapes. Tiny faces seemed to leer at him from their boles, and feral eyes gleamed in the depths of the bushes. Tendrils of white mist, which he had not seen from above, now drifted past his face, carrying the acrid odor of crushed herbs and unfamiliar spices. Kalam tried to talk to the two creatures who were leading him into an unfamiliar world, but although he could form the words, they came out strange and garbled. The fear and terror he had felt was fading now, and the urgency to be away from this place seemed unimaginably distant and unimportant. He felt himself slipping into an easy acceptance of the unreal situation. It was as if he were wandering through a dream, but at some deep, almost unconscious level, he realized that this was no dream. The fog lifted, thickened as they moved down into the hollow, and then it abruptly disappeared. Kalam looked around in dull confusion. The hollow seemed larger than he had first imagined it to be. It now stretched away to a misty horizon. Buildings shimmered in the distance, and the pale silver ball of the moon overhead now glowed with a wan, golden light like a morning sun. And the fairy host had gathered. They thronged the hollow in a colorful, murmuring mass, like a great swarm of insects. Many were like the two leading Kalam, thin, high-featured, elfin creatures dressed in shimmering garments which whispered together when they moved. There were others, small, gnarled, crooked creatures that seemed neither man nor beast, tiny creatures no longer than his hand who flew on huge butterfly wings. And there were small, but perfectly formed men clad in rough clothes of red, green, and brown. Some bowed mockingly to the young man as he was led through the mass, whilst others either ignored him or looked pityingly on him. The low susurration of voices stilled as he passed, and the throng backed away on either side, leaving an avenue down which he must pass. Facing him at the end, seated upon a cloth-draped tree stump, was a man, crowned like a king, and clad in a lord's finery. Kalam stood before the elfin lord, and stared deep into his colorless eyes. He felt he could drown in them. They were so empty. The king rose, and he was a head taller than the young man, and placed a long-fingered hand on his trembling shoulder. "I am Ilin, lord of the elfin folk." The company murmured their lord's name as if in benediction. "You are welcome to this gathering, son of man," he gestured about with his right hand. "Enjoy," he commanded, and resumed his seat. The young man was grabbed by two of the elfin maids and dragged into the whirling crowd. The fairy music began again. Two harpers, their instruments the most beautiful and delicate Kalam had ever seen, and a piper caressing an instrument which looked impossibly old. The music inflamed him. It was so wild and free, almost alive, not like the poor shadow of sound that passed from music in where? The faint echo of an air haunted the dim recesses of his mind. He groped for it with blind fingers, suddenly realizing that it was of immeasurable importance to him. One of the elfin maids pressed a goblet of purest silver into his hands and urged him to drink. He raised it to his lips, and the potent vapors made his head swim. But some primal warning urged him not to drink, no, nor eat the food of fairy. He worked his throat, but handed the maid back the goblet untasted. He refused all food, pretending to be chewing when someone offered him a delicacy. He danced with many of the elven maids, whirling around and around in a mad swirling that left him dizzy and gasping. Many of the fairy folk seemed to want to touch him as if he were some token or charm, and one, an old woman no taller than his waist, wept as she kissed his hand. The night, if night it was, passed swiftly, and as the dawn tinged the eastern sky with pale light, the tiny lanterns were extinguished, and one by one the fairy folk disappeared back into whatever time or place they inhabited. And as they did, the golden moon's sun faded from the skies and sank into the west. The trees and stones ceased to stare, and the sounds and smells of fairy faded, leaving only the mundane behind. Kalam stared suddenly. He had been staring into the eastern sky, welcoming and yet regretting the coming dawn. when someone touched his shoulder. It was Elon, the elfin lord. "You have cheated us, son of man."
I don't understand."
Elon gestured into the east. "The dawn is almost upon us, but the fairy folk are gone, and by rights you should have gone with them."
"But why?" wondered Colum.
"Why? Because you were part of a tribute paid to us by the one you know of as the O'Donnell."
"What tribute?"
"The soul of a baptized follower of the new god, the one you call the Christ. In return, we extend the life of the O'Donnell."
"How old is he?"
Colum asked suddenly.
"As we reckon time, 4 nights, you were to pay for that 4th night. But you cheated us, for you neither ate our food nor drank our wines, and thus we have no claim on you."
4 nights is not a long time," said Colum.
"Time, as we measure it," said the elfin lord, "differs greatly from your measurement of it. Look," he pointed into the east, "the sun arises. I must depart. I wish you well. Although I pity you, and soon you will wish you had followed us beyond this world into the Shadowland, the realm of fairy. Farewell." Elan, the lord of the elfin folk, moved across the hollow towards the west, and as he did so, a shadowy figure stepped from behind a tree and joined him. And Colum could have sworn that it was the O'Donnell. Then they were gone. The road back to the village was wrong. It was not something he could describe, more an overall impression. He had traveled that road for as long as he could remember. He knew every stone and crack in its rough surface, every tree and bush that lined the winding way, and every lichen-covered wall. But now they were different. Perhaps the road seemed wider, the bushes and trees just a little bigger, a little more unkempt than he remembered them. He noticed new bushes and young trees which he felt sure had not been there the night before, and there were also gaps where he knew there ought to be a certain bush or a low wall. He began to run. The sun came up and his dew-soaked clothes steamed in the hot summer air. Hot summer air? But it had been the depths of winter only last night. Filled with a mind-numbing fear, Colum fled towards the village. Everything on this road was so familiar and yet so strange, so old and yet so new. The village was much as he remembered it, perhaps the buildings a little more dilapidated and the church slightly more decrepit, but that gilt cross on the steeple was new. It had not been there last night. The inn was almost unchanged, save that the roof had been recently thatched. All conversation ceased as he entered its familiar dark, low-ceilinged interior, redolent with the heavy odors of strong spirits, stale beer, and sweat. Colum nodded to a score of faces he knew, or thought he knew, but they merely looked puzzled and were slow to return his greeting. He ordered a glass of dark beer and lounged back against the smooth wood of the bar. The locals, their scrutiny of the stranger finished, and apparently satisfied that he was one of themselves, turned their attention back to the old man in the corner by the turf fire. His voice was rough, for it had been a long night's storytelling and was only now coming to an end. He sipped from a heavy mug and resumed. "From this very spot it was, and sure wasn't it my father, God rest him, who saw him. Out he went, and with a few jars inside him, for it was a bitter night and cold enough to crack the stones, and he took the old straight road home." The storyteller paused and sipped his drink. "But he never reached it. Oh, there was a search made, of course, but sure he was gone, and there was little to be done about it. But," and the old man paused for effect, "they found a scrap of cloth torn from his coat just above the fairy dell in the O'Donnell's land. The fairies got him." "And who was he, and how long ago was this?" Colum asked into the silence. "Sure. And wasn't he a local lad, Colum McMahon? And it's nigh on 100 years since he went with the fairy host."
You've just been listening to me read The Fairy Host out of Irish Folk and Fairy Tales by Michael Scott. This is Ms. G. I've been bringing you Telling Tales with Ms. G. I hope you appreciated tonight's show and enjoyed it. And I will say goodnight, and new letters on the air are already in progress. Till next time.
Tragedy, then 8 tiers down, comedy, and then at the lowest, satire. And there's a suggestion that if you use humor, then your works cannot aspire towards